Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the Urban Music Debate and Takedowns on Twitch. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when Viagogo was given 5 days to address concerns about its StubHub merger in the UK.
Yeah, and as we record this podcast, those 5 days have already started ticking. We're on day 2 of the 5 days, which means by the time this podcast goes out, we'll sort of be in the middle of that time. Depending on how quickly you tune into this podcast after it's been published, maybe those 5 days will be up already. And if they are, I'm absolutely certain that good old Viagogo, consumer-friendly, trustworthy, always transparent Viagogo, will have gone to the Competition and Markets Authority, the competition regulator here in the UK, and reassured them fully that all of the concerns they have of Viagogo and StubHub, the two big second ticketing companies becoming one company, all those concerns will be over and that merger can go ahead. But although that $4 billion transaction, let's not forget, Viagogo spent $4 billion buying its rival StubHub just before COVID shutdown began.
Yes, not the best timed deal.
And although that transaction closed in February, the two companies haven't actually merged because of this competition regulator inquiry here in the UK. If Viagogo do not come back with lots of reassuring ideas in those 5 days, then the CMA will begin what they call a phase two investigation, a more in-depth investigation as to whether or not they should seek to block or somehow restrict the merger. Obviously, that could only apply to the UK. CMA only has jurisdiction here. But it is holding up the entire merger of StubHub and Viagogo worldwide. And given that both of those companies are currently going through some very tricky times because of the COVID-19 shutdown, I would suspect they are keen to get on with that merger. But that was one of the updates this week. It's one of those updates where by the time this podcast goes out, maybe what I'm saying will be out of date. But we thought we ought to acknowledge it, even though that's not what we're here to talk about.
No, this week we're actually going to be discussing Twitch's latest run-in with the music industry. But first, following the music industry's vow to address issues of racial discrimination earlier this month, as discussed on last week's episode, last week there was much debate around some of the language used by music companies. The One Little Indian record label announced that it was changing its name to One Little Independent due to harmful stereotyping and exploitation of Indigenous people's culture in its original name that it had had for 35 years. Elsewhere, a much older institution, the music venue Colston Hall in Bristol, confirmed plans to change its name so that it no longer commemorated someone who was heavily involved in the slave trade. And also outside music companies, artists were also making moves in this domain. Lady Antebellum, the country band in the US, announced that they were changing their name due to the word Antebellum's association with the slave trade in the United States. But one of the biggest debates of last week was the ongoing use of the term urban to categorise styles of music largely made by people of colour.
Yes, so as you've just illustrated, this particular strand of the debate that has escalated and evolved, particularly since the Blackout Tuesday initiative that happened at the start of the month, which obviously in turn was a response to all of the Black Lives Matter protests that have been happening in the US and all over the world, which in turn were a response to the controversial death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. But just this strand of the debate, and this is just, you know, one strand of very many different elements to this debate, just this strand of the debate about the terminology that people use for the names of their companies and their venues and their bands, etc., has many different elements to it. But as you say, in amongst all of that is the debate around the term urban music, which of course has traditionally and for quite a long time been used to apply to subgenres like rap and hip hop and modern R&B and other genres associated with those. Of course, opposition to the term urban within record companies, within the radio sector, on streaming services, on websites, in magazines, etc. This is not new. This term has been contentious for years within the music industry for various different reasons. But last week, in a week where a lot of commitments and a lot of decisions have been made in this domain, in the last week we saw some actual moves within the industry to officially, formally reject that term and to remove that term in record companies and beyond, which sort of then kickstarts yet another side debate as part of this massive debate, which is, if we're rejecting the term urban music, are we replacing it with something else? And if so, What else?
Yeah, so things kicked off with the announcement by the Universal-owned Republic Records that it was dropping the use of the word urban altogether with immediate effect. This meant not just dropping the labelling of music as urban, but also changing the name of whole departments and job titles as well. It's not 100% clear how those will be updated yet, but the commitment has been made. There were then various calls for the rest of the music industry to follow suit, including from a new organisation in the UK called the Black Music Coalition, which made five key demands on the music industry to address prejudice, discrimination and racism, one of which was ceasing to use that term.
So as I say, this isn't just something that affects record companies that have had labels termed urban, job titles turned urban, sections of their website turned urban. But beyond labels, it affects other organisations as well. Obviously, there were quite a lot of awards events that might have an urban category. That includes the Grammy Awards. And so another announcement that came out this week was from the producers of the Grammy Awards, the Recordings Academy in the US, that put out some statements about various changes it was making to its awards. I mean, the Grammy changes certain rules and regulations and award categories and titles every single year. So the statement they put out covered a number of changes that they were making. But one of the things that they announced is that they are going to change the name of what has previously been called the Best Urban Contemporary Album Award. And from now on, that will be known as the Best Progressive R&B Album Award.
Yeah, that was part of an update to a number of awards titles and their eligibility requirements. So as you say, the Best Urban Contemporary Album has become Best Progressive R&B Album. Then the Best Rap / Song Performance is now Best Melodic Rap Performance. And in the Latin music categories, slightly different, they've changed Best Latin Rock Urban or Alternative Album to the Best Latin Rock or Alternative Album. But rather than removing urban entirely, they have moved it over to Best Latin Pop Album, which becomes Best Latin Pop or Urban Album.
Yeah, as with most Grammy announcements, that was all a bit confusing, wasn't it?
Because it took a long time to work out what was happening there.
Because they were getting rid of the standalone urban contemporary album category and coming up with this term, progressive R&B, which no one's really sure what that means, but maybe
it sounds like it's going to be really long R&B tracks.
Yeah, prog R&B.
Lots of keyboard solos.
Maybe this will become a term that we start to use, or maybe everyone will get very confused about that. I mean, does that mean that other R&B is conservative R&B? Anyway, but yes, within the Latin categories, it actually initially looked, when you first glanced at the announcements, that despite having said we've decided we no longer want to use the word urban, it actually looked initially like, but hang on a second, you've added the word urban to what category? But they haven't. They've just rejigged the Latin categories so that the Latin urban releases, which previously would have been up against the Latin rock and the Latin alternative releases in a category, are now up against the Latin pop, which I guess makes more sense. To an extent, who knows? I mean, with all of this, both within the labels and even more so when it comes to award category names, it's one of those tricky things, isn't it? Because on one level, this is important, but then on another level, does it just raise as many questions and problems as it answers and solves? It's hard to know, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in part, this goes back to some comments made by Tyler, the Creator, at this year's Grammys after he won the Best Rap Album Award, where he said to a Rolling Stone journalist afterwards that he felt like getting that award was a bit of a backhanded compliment because his album, Igor, wasn't really a rap album. It was more of a pop album. And so he said, you know, why do I have to go into the rap category? Why can't I be considered a pop artist when I've made a pop album? So it's almost like a bit of a consolation prize where he's not seen as being right to be considered for a pop album where it is pop he's making. I mean, basically they've just gone like, yeah, that guy's a rapper, sure, and not properly considered what he's actually doing with his music now, which has changed a lot over the course of his career.
Yes, and you have to think that the changes that the Grammy Awards made last week won't really actually deal with that specific issue.
No.
In that, had this change been made 12 months ago, probably that album would have been up for Best Melodic Rap Performance, which doesn't really solve the problem. I mean, plenty of other people have made similar criticisms of particularly the Grammys, but some other awards as well, that it has often felt like Black artists are given the urban awards, the R&B awards and the rap awards, but not the non-genre specific awards, which are often the flagship awards that get all of the news coverage, even when there have been years where the artist who takes the best R&B album award or whatever it is, that album is clearly a definite contender for overall best album of the year, you know, oblivious of genre. So one of the criticisms is that these awards events are much more prone to give black artists their genre specific prizes rather than shortlisting them for the non-genre specific awards, even though clearly that is where they should be listed, either as well as or instead of the genre specific awards. And this relabeling, rebranding of awards isn't going to deal with that problem. And I think that's an important point about this wider issue. Labels and awards events and other organisations finally responding to criticism of this term urban and making these changes has been widely welcomed. But actually, I think the issue with the term urban, I mean, aside from the fact that it was stupid to suggest that this kind of music could only be made in a city, I mean, there are some fundamental issues with the word anyway. But I mean, even if we're willing to take the word as being abstract and divorced from its original meaning, there are a number of different issues with the labelling of certain artists and certain music under this urban banner within the music industry. And for example, some of the opinion pieces that have been shared over the last week talked about how in some of the bigger record companies, it was quite often the case that you would have an urban division and a country division, for example, but that the country division almost ran itself, and the people who were in charge of that division were very, very senior in the organisation, whereas the urban division was always seen as being more junior, even though, I mean, in the last 10 years, where has all the money been coming in? And that was one of the points that one of the op-ed pieces that was doing the rounds was making, which is maybe 25 years ago, when we were not the most lucrative bit of the company, we could understand why the boss of the urban division wasn't as senior as the boss of the country division. But in an era where many major record companies are being bankrolled to an extent, certainly in certain years, by black artists and the music that they are making, the fact that the urban divisions sometimes are not given the same seniority as, say, the country division, that's clearly a big issue. And so you have to think, what is a simple rebadging, relabeling? Is that going to do anything about that? Because that's actually nothing to do with the word urban. That's to do with the culture in the industry, which isn't to say that we shouldn't reject the word urban for all the various different reasons that people have talked about it. But if we just reject the word urban and don't do anything about the structural issues, then actually we've not solved the bigger issue. There are other reasons. I mean, I remember once I did a panel with the manager of a Jamaican artist who had signed to an American label, and they talked about how the label they'd signed to looked at the artist and then said, oh, you should go and talk to our urban marketing team, who then treated him like he was a hip-hop artist or a rap artist, which he wasn't. And it took the manager to go in and say, hang on a second, you've completely misunderstood the music my artist is making. We shouldn't be doing it in that way. We shouldn't be using that marketing team. This is what we need to do. Fortunately, the label listened to the manager and they did it a different way, and it was a very successful artist. But that's another issue with labels looking at the ethnicity of the artist, the colour of the artist's skin, and then making assumptions about the music they're making and how it should be marketed, rather than listening to the music and looking at what the artist is doing and how the artist is interacting with their fans and saying, OK, let's build a strategy for that. So these are all different issues. None of this is to say that we shouldn't be rejecting the term urban. And it has to be said, to be fair to record companies, for example, they have made many, many, many commitments to deal with all of these different issues. They definitely haven't just come forward with one token gesture proposal. But as I say, while this may be a good thing, we need to be very specific about all the various different issues that have been associated with the term urban over the years and make sure that we're dealing with all those specific issues as well.
Yeah, I think after so many years of all these arguments and debates kind of just being ignored, you know, there are whole record label departments with that name on the door. There are radio stations that would be badged as urban. And I suppose the continuation of those two different things is partly why the word continues to exist, even though the arguments against it are, as we've said, not new at all. But in the last week, it has been interesting to see people really properly facing those debates, like Republic saying, we're not going to use this term anymore. Like One Little Indian dropping the word Indian from its name after 35 years. And in that time, recently cannot have been the first time it had heard the arguments against that and the kind of cartoon Native American in their logo, which they're also getting rid of. But it's kind of people really looking at that and going, actually, yes, this is wrong. And although it's very late in the day, now is the time to change it. I mean, Lady Antebellum as well, changing their name was something I've always been a bit wary of writing about Lady Antebellum because I kind of, the first time I heard of them, I assumed they were some kind of white power band. And even when I know they're not, I've always been a bit like, are we supposed to be writing about them? Apparently we are. We can write about them now. They're Lady A now. I don't think I said that. And then the other thing, talking about structural change, BMG last week announced that it was going to go back over the next month through all of its contracts and look for racial bias in those and make changes where necessary. So obviously BMG in its current iteration isn't actually that old a company, but it has grown rapidly in the last decade by buying up lots of older catalogues, some of them stretching back quite a long way, where it is quite likely that deals have been done less favourably due to the colour of an artist's skin. And BMG is looking, among other things, to address that now. And it does seem that there are, therefore, some real moves to make changes in the music industry, given that the starting point of Blackout Tuesday was people saying, oh, people will just probably shut down for Tuesday and then not do anything. Stuff has happened since then. I mean, I hope it continues to happen. This isn't just a month of change and then falling back into old prejudices and old ways of working. But I guess we'll see. And dropping the word urban surely is one of those things that needs to be done.
So we'll see what further announcements are made across the wider music industry regarding the use of certain words in company names and artist names, etc., regarding the urban genre term and getting rid of that once and for all. But then, as you say, also those more important structural changes within music companies, including what BMG has now said that it is doing over the next month, because although the relabeling is an important part of this, in some ways it's that structural stuff that is going to have much more long-term impact. So I think we're going to have a lot more commitments coming in the next few weeks. It'll be interesting to see what those are. And then the real test is, yeah, in 6 months' time, how much of this has become real long-lasting change? And let's be optimistic and hope that this time, given how quickly and radically things seem to be changing in the last 10 days, that this time the changes are long-term.
And finally, the Amazon-owned live streaming platform Twitch last week revealed that it had recently received what it called an influx of takedown requests from the music industry. It issued a statement after a number of prolific streamers on Twitch complained that their channels had been targeted with copyright complaints, many of those relating to old videos, with the threat of being banned from the platform altogether if they failed to remove any unlicensed music from their archived content.
So in a way, this brings us back to the debate we were having on Setlist a few weeks ago about, with the rise of live streaming since COVID-19 shutdown began, the tedious yet important debate about which of the live streaming platforms that people have been using to perform music live or to do DJ sets or to otherwise live stream with music somehow involved in the experience. How many of those platforms are licensed by the music industry for the music contained in those live streams and or the recordings of those live streams that sometimes get spit out the other end and then stored on a website in some sort of archive? And as we discussed on that edition of Setlist, although live streaming is not new, and obviously within the live gaming space, Twitch has been a considerable phenomenon for quite a number of years now, but it has to be said that the music industry has in the main not put the spotlight on the licensing of live streaming platforms, which means that lots of platforms, including Twitch, owned by the incredibly cash-rich Amazon, have been able to get away with having people live streaming content that has music in it. As I say, that might be a live performance of music. It may be a DJ set. Certainly in the last year or so, Twitch, although as I say, still really known for the gamers that stream on that platform, has been courting other kinds of creators much more prolifically. But it doesn't just have to be an artist who's performing a song or a DJ who is doing a DJ set through the platform. It could be a gamer who has music playing in the background. Some gamers interact with their viewers by letting them pick what music is playing in the background. Or it may simply be the game they are playing's soundtrack. All of those things need to be licensed by record companies and music publishers and collecting societies. because the music industry has generally not gone full on enforcing these platforms to get licensed, there are plenty of platforms that people are now using for live streaming in various different ways, which are not licensed for the music contained in those streams. There are some platforms that you probably really think are licensed because maybe they are licensed for other parts of their operations, but they're not licensed at all or certainly fully for the live streaming side of their operations. So a lot of confusion abounds in this domain. Meanwhile, we sense that the lawyers and the business affairs teams and the anti-piracy teams at the big music companies are starting to look at those platforms, and there's two sides to that. One is we start chasing these people to get licenses, potentially with the threat of legal action if they don't. Meanwhile, we start using the safe harbor principles in copyright law to start issuing takedown notices against these platforms, ordering them to remove any videos that have been uploaded by users on their platforms that contain other people's music that was not licensed.
Yeah, this is something that's come up before, actually. In 2018, Twitch reported that it was suddenly getting a lot of takedown notices from the IFPI, although that story seems to have kind of drifted away. Now, presumably because of the increased focus on live streaming, music companies are starting to look at what licenses are in place and what music is being used. And so suddenly, Twitch is being targeted again. And so with an increased number of Twitch users being impacted by copyright complaints, the platform was very keen to stress that its policies regarding music in its user streams had not actually changed at all. And it was just that the music industry was suddenly taking a lot more notice of it. Because obviously, I think when the user gets a notification, it looks like it's come from Twitch saying, you can't use this music. And therefore, people were really complaining to Twitch and saying, why have you suddenly decided I can't use this music? And so that's why it put out its statement, in part to explain that it wasn't all its fault. It said, we've had a sudden influx of DMCA takedown requests for clips with background music from 2017 to 19. If you're unsure about rights to audio in past streams, we advise removing those clips. We know many of you have large archives and we're working to make this easier. It added, this is the first time we've received mass DMCA claims against clips. We understand that this has been stressful for affected creators and are working on solutions, including examining how we can give you more control over your clips. So it says that's the first time it's received mass DMCA takedown notices, which suggests it's either forgotten about the last time or it wasn't actually that many clips last time it complained about this.
Yeah, maybe it felt like a lot of takedown requests 2 years ago until they saw how many takedown requests they're getting now. And with hindsight, they weren't getting many 2 years ago. DMCA, of course, is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That's the piece of American copyright law which contains the aforementioned safe harbour. So for Twitch itself not to be held liable for all the infringing music that's in its users' videos, it has to have a system for accepting and dealing with these takedown requests. And although in these statements, Twitch was ultimately trying to placate its users, particularly those who have been using the platform for a long time, have quite significant archives, and we're being threatened with having their channels closed down. But at the same time, it was also keen to stress that they respect the DMCA, they respect copyright, and they will always deal with takedown requests. They have to do that, otherwise they themselves could be sued for copyright infringement. And of course, while we're talking about safe harbours, we know, because we've talked about it endlessly on Setlist, although when people talk about safe harbour, they are generally talking about the DMCA safe harbour in America. In Europe, in the European Union, the equivalent safe harbour, which actually originated in an e-commerce directive of the European Union, that's being reformed as a result of last year's European Copyright Directive, not in the UK, because Brexit Britain's not implementing that directive. But in the rest of the EU, the safe harbour is in flux. And I think it's interesting because obviously when all that safe harbour reform was happening last year and towards the end of 2018 as well, it ended up very much being pitched in the press as being a YouTube versus the music industry battle, and that it was YouTube that was going to be massively hit by any new laws that increased the liabilities of user upload platforms when it comes to unlicensed music. It could well end up that it's not really YouTube that's affected by the changes in the EU, and indeed any subsequent changes that the music industry manages to get in America, given that Safe Harbor is back on the agenda in Washington as well. It could end up that actually it is the live streaming platforms that end up really feeling the heat as a result of these new liabilities. And if that is the case, if it is the live streaming platforms that ultimately the music industry ends up going after to test these new liabilities in European law, well, if you're going to go after a live streaming platform, why not go after the one owned by the the uber-rich Amazon. It seems like the logical place to start. So I suspect that Twitch are particularly sensitive about being seen to be doing the right thing for copyright owners at the moment, while also trying not to piss off their users too much, because the safe harbour that they are relying on to avoid liability themselves is very much in flux. Obviously, if Amazon and Twitch want to keep the copyright owners happy and their users happy, I mean, as you say, in that statement, they implied that there would be some new tools being introduced to help live streamers on their platform when it comes to things like music rights. But the real solution is for Twitch to get sorted proper deals with record companies and the music publishers and collecting societies. I mean, any setlist listener also knows that's not as easy as it sounds, even when you have the deep pockets of Amazon. But it does feel like that is where this is going to have to go. And the more Twitch pushes to try and get musicians and artists and other sorts of creators onto its platform, the more important getting those deals sorted is going to be. So we wait to see, beyond statements and any little extra tools in the back end on Twitch, how its relationship with the music industry evolves.
Yeah, and although obviously Amazon and the music industry have a very long relationship, Amazon's obviously one of the biggest sellers of physical media, but it has had run-ins in the past. Some people might remember Amazon's digital locker service, which it for a long time argued didn't need licenses when the music industry said it did. But in the end, they did get licenses. Obviously, since then, digital lockers are a thing of something like the 18th century now, and streaming services came along. I mean, I think streaming services had already come along when Amazon was trying to do a digital locker service, but still, streaming has very much usurped that now, and Amazon obviously has several different versions of a streaming service available, all of which are fully licensed. And so in a digital domain, Amazon's very much up on licensing of music on its platforms. I suppose it might come as a surprise to some people to learn that Twitch is owned by Amazon, although I think it bought it in 2014. So it's not a new deal that's been done recently, but I think Twitch is still seen as kind of this independent thing on its own, but it is owned by one of the big online companies. And so it's clearly going to come under scrutiny by the music industry before some of the smaller services that it might want to look at. Obviously, there is a big question, as you've said, where licenses do and don't apply for live streaming in the instances that companies already have licenses in place for the use of music like YouTube or Facebook or Instagram. And to be fair to the live streaming platforms, it's not always clear who needs to provide the license, particularly on the song side. So you could maybe give them some benefit of the doubt there. And obviously, until recently, no one's really paid that much attention to live streaming and what licenses need to be applied. And so it's this sudden boom in live streaming that's happened as a result of the COVID-19 shutdown that has raised all these questions properly now. And the reason why we're seeing the music industry start to act, obviously at the moment, the music industry doesn't want to stop musicians from being able to perform online. So perhaps they are taking Twitch as a test case because it's less associated with music than other things are. Maybe it's just, I don't know, they just noticed Twitch for the first time in a couple of years and went, oh yeah, that thing, we should have a go at that again.
Yeah, I suppose if you didn't want to give them the benefit of the doubt that you were just generously offering, you could say, given they did, as you've mentioned several times, have a little flurry of takedown letters from the FBI 2 years ago, maybe they should have sorted it all out then, and then it wouldn't be an issue now. But we will see what happens next with regards music on Twitch and potentially all of those prolific popular gamers getting kicked off because they had Spotify playing in the background once and they didn't have a license for that.
Yeah, but that's all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. Remember to subscribe, rate, review. Hey, email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. I don't think I've mentioned that for a while. You can get in touch and talk to us about stuff if you want and don't like social media. We offer all sorts of options. You could send us a postcard, although we can't go and get our post at the moment, so don't do that. That's not a good idea. Anyway, that's it for this week. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.